It's 1 o'clock, so it's time to begin our Friday lunch lecture today. My name is Joanna Gompa. I'm a fellow at the Lauf Center for International Law, and it is my pleasure today to welcome our distinguished guest, Dr. Anil Yilmaz-Vastavidis. I'm welcoming her on behalf of the Lauterbach Center, of all the participants, both those who have come in person and online, and on behalf of Cambridge University Press, which has kindly sponsored our tasty sandwiches. Dr. Vastavidis is a senior lecturer at the Essex School of Law, and she's co-director of the Essex Business and Human Rights Project. Her areas of interest include international investment law, business conduct, human rights, and the interactions between those fields. She focuses on the implementation of human rights standards in international investment law and respect to business conduct. She has many publications on these topics, and her more recent substantive publication is a monograph on nationality of corporate investors in international investment law. Today, Dr. Vastavidis will be talking about oil and water in the context of international investment law and climate action, which is a very timely topic, much debated. There is some recent statistical information. Last year, for the first time in history, global investments in wind and solar assets exceeded investments in gas and oil wells. So a lot happening, and we look forward to your presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joanna. I didn't know that investments in renewable energy is exceeding for the first time investments in fossil fuels. That's great. I'm gonna go there, I think.
Yes.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I would like to thank Surabhi as well. I know she's not here today, for the invitation. It's a privilege to be here and to be speaking with such an engaging group of scholars. I just want to start my talk by saying that this is a new area in my research. So I've started recently looking at the interaction between climate change and international investment law. It is a vibrant area of research. There are more and more scholars working on this interaction, and all things climate change, really. These are my kind of initial thoughts and findings and ideas. So I'm really looking forward to exchanging views with people here to see what they think and see any blind spots and things that I am missing from the discussion. So hopefully this will become a journal article at some point in the coming future. I wanted to put this picture here to give context to my talk, because there's a lot of discussion in investment law, in international investment law, on the reform of the international investment treaty framework, on reform of domestic laws governing investment, foreign investment. There's this parallel debate on how to best tackle climate change. There are many different interactions between law and climate policymaking, obviously. This is just one of that. I thought that, you know, we should all kind of bear in mind when we're thinking about law reform and reforming investment law, reforming protection frameworks for investments, that there is no business on a dead planet. I think that's a really good slogan. Right. So I just wanted to kind of start by saying that international investment law, I don't know if people in the audience are already familiar with what international investment law does. If not, I can kind of start with some basics. It basically provides protections, international protections to foreign investors when governments reach international standards that are usually incorporated in investment treaties, and governments have to pay compensation if they breach their obligations to investors. Now, recently, there's been a lot of debate around whether investment treaties, investment law commitments of states are making climate action more costly for governments. And this kind of follows on from past debates and ongoing debates around investment law, around the interaction of investment law and human rights and other public interest regulation, and how potentially investment law restrains government's policy space in enacting public policy-oriented regulations. So several scholars have identified that climate action-induced asset stranding is likely to give rise to quite a lot of investment treaty claims. And this can cause, on one hand, this may cause regulatory chill. So it may cause governments to act slower or take a step back on introducing regulations that aim to phase out fossil fuels or reduce fossil fuel subsidies. The other thing is that even if they go ahead and introduce these obligations, governments may end up paying large amounts of compensation to investors for having interfered with their assets and investments. So that then makes it costlier for governments to take action. I looked at how much of assets are expected to be stranded if we aim to reach our Paris Agreement goal, which is to meet the 1.5 degrees Celsius goal that the Paris Agreement sets in terms of global warming. We basically need to strand 60% of all oil and gas and 90% of all coal. It must remain unextracted so that we meet these goals. And this includes some ongoing projects being canceled and future projects being not given permission to go ahead. And that, you can imagine, can give rise to significant amount of claims against governments. If investors have invested or have started investing, even started to explore for these natural resources, and governments change course and decide to hold those investments, investors will be probably entitled to compensation. It's hard to predict exactly how the cases will be decided, but looking at past instances of environmental regulation-related claims, there's going to be likely a lot of investment treaty claims arising from this transition. There may be also other policy reforms that arise from that we can't even imagine yet from a green transition and adaptation and mitigation measures. So I think there's a lot of uncertainty around what we can expect from governments and what businesses can expect, and that those can give rise to claims. So I started by looking at past investment awards, recent and more dated ones, to see how arbitral tribunals have dealt with measures, environmental measures, and that environmental measures that led to cancellation of investments or investor licenses, etc. So the typical claim would be an investor would claim that their investment was either indirectly expropriated, and they would be treated unfairly by the government in the process of a new law or a new regulation that basically either renders their investment incompatible with environmental regulations or a cancellation of a license. So these cases, the cases that I looked at and read really carefully again, were TechMed, MetaCloud, Bilken, Eco Oro, and recently awarded the Lone Pine claim, which only was published a few weeks ago, and RockHopper and Italy. These are more recent claims, and TechMed and MetaCloud are old claims decisions. And when we look at these decisions very carefully, we can see a pattern of how investment tribunals have interpreted investment treaty provisions and how they viewed environmentally kind of induced laws and their impact on the investors' investment. I'll just kind of talk a little bit about the most recent one, which is the RockHopper and Italy claim. And these are the RockHopper penguins, by the way. The company is named after these penguins that are indigenous to the Falklands Islands. And now this company will be using the, according to their report, they're going to be using the compensation award that they obtained from Italy in this particular case to invest in oil and gas projects in Falklands Islands, where these particular penguins are at risk of extinction. So kind of this kind of shows us the broader context of the challenges and the issues. In the RockHopper claim, the investors' project to drill offshore off the coast of Italy was after a rocky kind of process of whether they're going to have a license to exploit or not. After having an exploration license and exploring the feasibility of the project, eventually their license was canceled. The area was considered off limits for oil drilling because of environmental reasons. And RockHopper filed this claim against Italy, arguing that it's, and this was under the Energy Charter Treaty, and they argued that their investment was expropriated and they were failed to be accorded a fair and equitable treatment by Italy. I won't go into all the details of the case, which might be necessary to have a nuanced discussion, but for the purposes of my presentation, I just want to say that this was kind of the tribunal in that decision acknowledged the importance of the environmental issues, but then said this is a matter that is distinct from the environmental questions, whether the investor is entitled to compensation. It's the question of whether their investment was expropriated or not. And the environmental considerations do not really play an important role in that discussion. And since Italy, according to the tribunal, expropriated indirectly the investment of RockHopper, an investment that had not even started, they were entitled to compensation. Another important issue that we need to think about when we're talking about investment law and climate change is the valuation of damages. So it may not be such a big issue if an investor's investment is expropriated and they will obviously be entitled to compensation because a legal compensation requires a public purpose and payment of compensation. But the question is how much that compensation is going to be. And that's another very contested issue in investment law. The valuation of damages have been overly generous. And that, again, poses questions around the compatibility of investment law with governments taking climate action, because it can drastically increase the cost of climate action, of climate policies, by challenging the legality of government's policy choices and awarding seriously high amounts of compensation. And that takes me to the question, then how should we need this green transition for our planet and humanity to survive? We know that we're going to gradually be reducing our reliance on fossil fuels. We're going to be transitioning into a greener economy, hopefully. But then this comes with a massive cost, and who pays, who bears the cost of this? And who takes the burdens of that, and how that is distributed within society is a big question. And I think what international investment treaties do is to kind of influence that distribution by allocating the funds of fossil fuel transition to investors in the forms of these huge amounts of compensation. Right, so that's one question that I would like to explore a bit more in this research. And I would like to kind of seek views and discuss this with Mene as well. So the role of what I see is that investment treaties are among the instruments that allow in fossil fuel industry to cash in on this green transition. So the other side of the coin is that there is an argument that investment law can be an enabler of green transition. So yes, it may make it costlier in the case of fossil fuel investments, but on the other hand, we need more renewable energy investments. And if we look at the Paris Agreement, governments have committed to enable financial flows for transition to a low emission economy, especially for the countries in the global south. They need these investments. They need more foreign direct investments and technology transfer to achieve a green transition in terms of, especially in the area of renewable energy. And the OECD in a 2022 report said that investment treaties form an important part of the public policy framework for these finance flows in order to achieve a green transition, which sounds really, convincing. However, we have seen some recent claims in the renewable energy sector by renewable energy firms in Europe, particularly, having received subsidies from governments or other kinds of incentives to set up, because this is a heavy cost investment. It's the initial costs are really heavy for renewable energy investments, which is the same for fossil fuels, obviously. And so governments have given incentives, and then they reduced those incentives, and that gave rise to investment treaty claims. Some were successful, some were unsuccessful. But the question arises when we're thinking about investment treaties as an enabler of green transition. We need to first ask ourselves, are investment treaties actually necessary to attract investments, to promote investments in these green energy sectors? So if we look at the literature, there's obviously this is all recent, so the literature on this is recent as well. But Kaila Tienhara has argued that there is a lack of evidence, first of all, on investment law's positive role in its current form, at least, to attract more investments in energy sectors. And this there's obviously inconclusive evidence on the role of investment treaties in increasing energy investments flows in general. But in the specific case of renewable energy, there is also not any evidence that tells us that investors are looking at treaties to invest. And then there was a recent article by Matteo Farmeglia, who looked at the valuation of damages in these energy charter treaty claims in the renewable energy sector. And he argues that they are overly generous. So they basically allowed investors in renewable energy to profit for a second time through these claims from their investments. So, and I think it's important to remember that, yes, we want more green energy, but we also need to think about balancing those goals with other human rights considerations. So, for example, there are a lot of questions around lithium extraction and the impact of that lithium mining on local communities. So it's not just that green energy is going to be good and we should just support it, but we need to kind of consider the complexities of that and the role of investment law within that matrix. Academics have argued that maybe we, instead of looking at traditional investment treaties, we can focus on investment liberalization, more kind of focusing on market access and reducing performance requirements, etc., rather than providing the standard protections that we see in investment treaties and investment arbitration. So that's another possibility. So as all this discussion is going on in the literature, I wondered whether before we, at least before I take sides in this debate and decide, you know, what kind of reform do we need for investment treaties to ensure that they're climate compatible, I just wanted to look at, excuse me, go kind of deeper and look at what are we looking at? What is the context in which investment law is operating and in which we're taking these climate change measures around the world? So I stumbled into this discussion in social science on how climate change is a super wicked problem. And that means that it is it has multiple and complex causes. So we don't fully know. We know some causes of it, but there are also areas in which we are, science is still uncertain. And the impacts are interrelated, and it's kind of, it requires global responses as well as local responses. There is no single path to tackling the problem. And when we think that we found a solution to a problem, we might have to change or amend that solution. And the solutions that we are proposing could cause other problems. There's constantly evolving scientific evidence, and we're constantly learning. And we live in a world that heavily depends on fossil fuels. So what a green transition requires is for us to completely change the way we live, the way we do business, the way we learn things. It requires a fundamental shift. And this will obviously not happen overnight. It's going to happen gradually. And the longer it takes to address the problems, the harder they are becoming to address. So I was reading a paper from Usha Natarajan. She's a critical whale scholar who writes on environment. And in her article, she was saying that since the Rio Declaration and since the 1992 Climate Convention, there's been more greenhouse gas emissions than ever. We have all these treaties on paper and policies, but in terms of greenhouse gas emissions or the way we live and the way we burn fossil fuels, nothing has changed. It has only gotten worse. And so if we look at the nature of the problem, it's going to be impossible for a green transition to be done orderly in the eyes of international investment law. And kind of, I find myself often in a place between reform and resistance. And this is from Luis Eslava and Sufi's article on whale reform and resistance. On one hand, I think we need reforms that will provide us with practical solutions to this problem of investment law acting as a barrier or an obstacle to climate transition. But on the other hand, there are those that resist and they say we should just abandon this system. And that's not easy either, because even if you were to, as a government, to leave investment treaties, to denounce your investment treaties, they all have survival clauses, so they're going to be still applicable for another 10 or 20 years. So when we are then I'm kind of in a place where I'm in favor of reforming if we can't abandon the system. But when we're thinking of reforms, we need to think about fundamental aspects of international investment law and compare this with what is needed for a green transition and see if within the current philosophy of international investment law, whether it's possible for us to even modify it in a way that will be compatible with climate change objectives. So when thinking about this, I started kind of thinking about investment law as a set of principles that aim to neutralize change and minimize risk for investments. So what is very much disliked in investment treaty award is change. When investors are promised something, or if they enter into a country within a certain regulatory climate, and if there's a change happening after they've already started their investment, investment law doesn't like that. At least investment arbitration awards don't. And the idea is to minimize risk. And the other feature of investment law that is, I think, very problematic from a climate change, climate action perspective is that it has this state investor dichotomy. So even when we are looking at reforming, we're always looking at giving more policy space to governments, but governments aren't acting as well. So yes, it may be a relationship from the eyes of investment law between an investor and a state, but states are also culprits here. So if we're trying to give more space to governments, we're not really dealing with the essence of the problem. And if we consider climate change as a super big problem, we can think about, we can kind of easily conclude that there is going to be a lot of change coming, and that change is going to be a problem in the eyes of international investment law. And even if we look at international environmental law principles, such as prevention, precautionary principle, and polluter pay principles, we need to think about the relationship between those principles and how they would operate in the eyes of international investment law standards. And finally, the role of public participation in environmental and climate policymaking, which I think should not be undermined, because as I will talk about this a little bit later, it's not without protest that governments protest and pressure from the public that governments actually take action. Right, so just kind of the final few points that I want to make. So when I'm looking at the compatibility of investment law with climate action, I want to kind of focus on in this research on the two things. One is this idea of investment law as a neutralizer of change, because it predicts, it expects that government will act with certainty and consistency, and there is going to be stability and predictability for the investor at all times. Minor changes are tolerated, but significant changes, like the ones that are expected to happen with green transition, are not welcomed. And if we look at cases and read carefully those awards, we can see that investors are entitled to stability and predictability. So when that changes, when governments interfere with that, they have to pay compensation. So that means that governments can still change things, but they have to pay. And that's the message that we got from Rockhopper, from the Rockhopper decision, that governments and states have the space to change their laws and improve their regulations, but they just have to pay compensation. But here, I don't think it's that easy to say, okay, they will just pay compensation, because that is what is making climate action more costly. And that brings me back to the question of who pays for this green transition. and how do we distribute the costs of this massive undertaking? On one hand, investment law demands stability. On the other hand, climate action requires rapidly changing responses. There's evolving science, there's impacts, uncertain impacts of policies. And even if we kind of go back to the international environmental law principles, like the precautionary principle, we see that it, again, demands states to exercise due diligence and take appropriate measures to monitor, adapt as risks evolve. And that doesn't sit well with international law principles. Going back to the question of who pays, according to international environmental law, polluter pays for the damaging activity. But according to investment law, the governments will have to compensate fossil fuel companies or other carbon-intensive industries for basically this green transition measures. And then we now have, we don't know exactly what will emerge, but we have several requests for advisory opinions from different international and regional courts. So we're going to see what they decide in terms of what we expect from states, what state obligations are under international law in terms of climate change. So here is the first kind of tension between investment law and climate action. One demands stability, the other demands constant change and responding to different circumstances. The second area that I want to look at more is the distaste of international investment law towards community opposition or policies that were triggered after protests or community mobilizations. When one reads these awards really carefully, you can see the hints in the awards that it would have been all fine, but the government was simply responding to these domestic pressures. And this is why they canceled the license of the investor, is one example. And so there is a real kind of problem, I think, there with the approach of International Investment Arbitration Tribunal towards policies that have been enacted after social mobilizations. These are often viewed as political, irrational, inconsistent, or arbitrary, because they weren't necessarily based on science, or even if the science was there, but the government actually responded to the protests and it was political. Because in investment law attempts to shield investors from political risk, if you label social mobilizations as political, then you can penalize governments for responding to the public opinion. So in the Rockhopper Award, for example, the tribunal really distinguished between the local protests that led to the government to actually acting to restrict oil drilling in that area. That was labeled as, this is political and civic engagements. But here we're talking about international legal responsibility of the government for having expropriated the investment. And I don't understand how the two can be detached from each other, because they're so, so connected and intertwined. Now, while investment law penalizes governments for responding to social mobilizations, if we look at emerging climate treaties and climate obligations, there we see public participation as a central element, as we do in international environmental law principles. Public participation is expected in all climate change related activities, according to the Special Rapporteur on the Right to Health and the Right to a Healthy Environment. So it becomes really complicated to make sense of these public participation or the public participation requirements within the framework of investment law. Another aspect that we need to think about is often it is these mobilizations that push governments to actually do what they're supposed to be doing. Without public outcry, we often see in all parts of the world, we don't see readily governments acting to enact progressive regulatory measures like those that relate to climate change. In her recent book, Zoe Williams looked at the causes of investment treaty disputes and how they emerge. And what she found was that it's often democratic pressures like voting, protests, or campaigning that led to the policy decisions that were responsible for investment arbitration claims. So here, I think if we're looking at reforming investment treaties or international investment law more generally to make it more climate compatible, we cannot overlook these aspects of international investment law. So its objectives of stability, certainty, and predictability is really a barrier to its compatibility with climate action. And it also stifles possibilities of an inclusive an ecologically appropriate model of investment governance because it's focusing on the government's regulatory space. It excludes local communities or publics from decision-making. So at the end of the day, you're before an investment arbitration tribunal. There are lawyers, there are representatives of states and the investor, but the people who are affected or the people who were mobilizing to introduce a certain regulation are not heard in this framework. They aren't present. Maybe they can be through an amicus brief, but that's very limited. That has a very limited influence. So that it's not a really inclusive system. So if we are only looking at giving more policy space to governments, that's just going to offer us very limited progress because we need to look at a completely different model of foreign investment governance that includes local communities or public groups, civil society in the process from the start of the investment. And I think this is happening when we look at business and human rights, when we look at UN guiding principles, there is a real call for investors or businesses to include from the start of a project local communities in the decision-making process. But when it comes to disputes that come after, in the context of investment law, they're completely excluded. And just final thought is that I think, as we may have all experienced one time or another, without the pressure of the public or communities and social movements, governments fail to take action. And we're seeing this day in and day out. So I think, you know, viewing this in social mobilizations as a contributor to an investment treaty breach is quite problematic. If we really want to introduce climate-friendly investment treaties or investment protection frameworks, we need to zoom out and look at these realities that are embedded in investment treaties. I'm just going to end it there. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this very interesting presentation.